This episode of the Sleep Apnea Stories podcast is sponsored by Aeroflow Sleep. Aeroflow Sleep is the nation's fastest growing durable medical equipment company, supplying CPAP machines, masks, and accessories to sleep apnea patients with eligible insurance plans. Not only do they conveniently ship CPAP supplies right to your door, Aeroflow Sleep takes it upon themselves to navigate the complexities of the insurance process. They speak to your doctor on your behalf so you can be confident in the treatment and coverage you receive without lifting a finger. If you're due for replacement parts, Aeroflow Sleep takes care of that too. They inform you exactly what's needed and when through a state-of-the-art online patient portal or via your preferred method of contact. I learned about Aeroflow Sleep 3 years ago, and I now support them as their patient advocacy expert. And what I love is that they're not just providing you with a product. They're genuine people. They're ready to serve you and looking to put the care back into healthcare. To learn more, visit their website at aeroflowsleep.com. That's A-E-R-O-F-L-O-W sleep.com. And learn more about Aeroflow Sleep today. On this podcast, we discuss medical diagnoses and procedures. All of the guests express their own opinions. You should always seek medical advice from a trained and credentialed professional when making decisions about your own health. Welcome to the Sleep Apnea Stories podcast. I'm Emma Cooksey, and I've been coping with sleep apnea since childhood. I didn't know anyone in my life with a sleep disorder, so I decided to start this podcast. I'm here to build community and provide a platform for people with sleep apnea to tell their stories. Together, we can shatter stereotypes and raise awareness. We'll be exploring all sorts of treatment options and lifestyle choices to help you live your best life with sleep apnea. This is Sleep Apnea Stories, and I'm so glad you're here. It's Emma Cooksey here, and I'm your host. So I'm back after a little break, and there's a season of 10 episodes coming up, and I'm really excited to share them with you. So today is my conversation with Molly Eastman, who is actually my friend. So if you think that I'm overfamiliar, it's because we've known each other for a few years now. So Molly is the creator of Sleep is a Skill and the host of the Sleep is a Skill podcast. Sleep is a Skill's a company that optimizes people's sleep through a unique blend of technology, accountability, and behavioral change. So Molly shares in this episode a little bit about her own story with her sleep and how she found herself kind of creating the resources that weren't already out there. So I think you're going to find it helpful. She's really into practical things that you can do in your life to improve your sleep. And I know from working with her behind the scenes that she cares so much about people with sleep apnea getting the testing, diagnosis, and treatment that they need. I know that sometimes, you know, people are like, what does a sleep coach do? Well, in Molly's case, she's holding people's hands through that process and really encouraging people to get their diagnosis and get some treatment. But I think that oftentimes people with sleep apnea, I mean, I'm absolutely in this camp. We think that everything going on with our sleep is because we have sleep apnea. And some of the suggestions Molly has about, you know, trying to really work with your circadian rhythm and, you know, just have habits that are helpful to your sleep overall, there are things that everybody can be doing. And I do think that's really helpful as a reminder. We want to treat our sleep apnea, but we also want to do things, you know, during the day that are helping support our sleep at night. So without further ado, here is my conversation with my friend, Molly Eastman. So Molly, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. You know, I'm a longtime fan. I recommend your podcast all the time. I feel like the work you're doing is so important. So it's an honor to be here.
Back at you. I feel like I got that whenever you post very kindly on your stories about my podcast or my page on Instagram, you're always like, if you have sleep apnea and you're not following her, what are you even doing? So now I'm like saying that about you as well. Yep. Like, if you're not following Molly, what are you even doing?
What are you even doing? Yeah, so. And truly, because it's so interesting, I have shared you to people who, one, they think they might have sleep apnea and they just are at a loss and they want support. Yeah. So that group. Then the people that have been diagnosed with sleep apnea and they're longtime CPAP users for years and years, and yet maybe are out of the conversation of all the things that they could be doing to further improve that experience.
And then three. Comfy.
Exactly. And then three, the group that is also, as I'm sure you have that pain point of the people that are diagnosed and yet aren't even treating it because they couldn't bring about that compliance factor, that age-old problem, and they're really at a loss. Yeah. So there's just a lot of groups that can be served by what you're doing.
So take us back, Molly, to where you even started in this whole sleep journey. So I think for a lot of people out there, they might not know your backstory of how your sleep sort of got you into all of this. So do you want to just start there?
Absolutely, because it is a wildly circuitous route. I did not imagine that my life would now be dedicated. I am a woman on a mission now. We have weird jobs, except when you and I are at the sleep conferences and stuff, we're sort of like the oddballs.
Yeah.
Like, who are these women? So I was not intending to be in the realm of sleep, and now I am so grateful for this path. But what it looked like is this. I now think of my life in a three-part series. And what I think of is truly at its core, this change with my sleep. And what it looked like was before I went through a period of a true, real breakdown in my life. And it was really met with problems with my sleep. And that was kind of at its lowest rock bottom period, what that looked like during and after. So the before was filled with simply a lot of labels and narratives around my sleep. So I'd say things like, I'm a short sleeper, I'm a night owl, it's in my genes, I'll sleep when I'm dead, you know, so these kind of fixed ways of relating to my sleep, and then just kind of a survival mode. It's how, you know, these are the cards I'm dealt. What's the big deal? Nothing to really look at. It's simply how it is for me. And I really thought like that as a kid, as, you know, going to the sleepovers, one of the last people to fall asleep. I always had it that I had trouble with that. As I got older, teenage years, college years, my behaviors became more exaggerated. So meaning I'm like going to bed later and later, and certainly in college, the all-nighters, I brought Adderall into the mix of things. Oh, you know, all the things that might not be serving some of our sleep results. And so that's what things look like. And flash forward, as I become a serial entrepreneur in Manhattan, burning the candle at both ends, now I am making my own hours. And at this point, I'm being justified and righteous. And I'll say, well, what's the big deal? I'll just sleep in later. There's not really a problem here. And unbeknownst to me, not connecting or correlating some of the deleterious effects with my health and well-being. What did those look like? It looked like the beginnings of an ulcer, shingles in my 20s, rising anxiety. As far as for the women listening, different difficulties with my cycle and painful cycles and endometriosis, psoriasis, a number of things that are pointing to the fact that something's not quite working with my health and I'm not connecting the dots that my sleep has much to do with it.
So you're not going to the doctor at that point and saying, I'm having a tough time sleeping. You're just seeing all these other health problems.
Absolutely. And seeing all these other health problems and unfortunately going to the doctors and coming back with, you know, everything looks fine, you're good to go. And so what would happen as a result is now I'm just kind of pushing the envelope. I have a lot, I don't know what I don't know. And so the way I'm managing my sleep is one that's really now in retrospect, not serving me. And what ended up happening with lots of stress with my businesses, my husband, we've been together for 13 years and he's a serial entrepreneur. I was, you know, a budding entrepreneur, but still lots of uncertainty and stress and what life looked like was finally this real kind of breakdown around the management of that stress load. And how it got exhibited for me was through my sleep. And suddenly I was dealing with really insomnia, difficulty falling asleep, staying asleep, early morning awakenings, in to a level that I just had no concept of how to navigate. And at the time we had done something, if you're an entrepreneur, you might be or interested in some of these conversations. We had read Tim Ferriss's 4-hour work week and decided to, let's become digital nomads, put all of our stuff in storage, one-way ticket. We land in Madrid. I'm now dealing with jet lag, and I grew up with no real money. I never really traveled much. I didn't really know how to deal with this, paired with all this stress and an immediate sense of, oh no, did we make a mistake? This is so much that we're putting on our plate now. And so I have a panic attack that first night. And that first night, then I...
Was that the first time you ever had a panic attack?
It was actually, I'd had one right before leading up to all this, you know, change, this big major life change. And so that was already putting me a bit more on edge. Like, you know, definitely that wired but tired thing started to come about. And so
Which is also completely normalized. I feel like people, like, you know, they're in that zone of working. It's like, people are anxious and panicky and they think that that's really normal.
And I totally thought it was normal. And certainly I had had a narrative that my family has a lot of mental health issues, some anxiety and what have you. So it was just, I guess that's just coming at me. And here we go. I got to figure this out now.
Yeah.
Then a layer in the sleep. So now I've had this panic attack. I've been up for hours with the jet lag, and now I'm up even longer. And now I'm starting to get nervous, and it keeps going, and I'm not knowing how to manage it. So then some days I'm sleeping in really late, trying to grab at straws of any type of sleep I can get. And we see this often for people with insomnia, spending an inordinate amount of time in bed trying to pull out some of that sleep. So this keeps going on. Now I'm starting to get scared because time is going and I'm responsible for things. I've got these businesses. I need to be managing my productivity and I'm just not able to show up. So then eventually I'm at my wit's end. We go to the doctors. We're actually in Croatia at this point with Google Translate. Thank goodness for technology. And yet I leave with sleeping pills. And in that moment have this sense that, all right, one, I'm desperate, so I'm going to take these things. And yet, two, I'm feeling shameful and embarrassed and like incredibly disempowered in that moment. And then finally, this moment comes to me of it feels as if I'm going to figure this out, I got to just go all in and understand what does it take, almost this quest to figure out what does it take to get great sleep. Now, not from a esoteric reason, but because I'm scared and terrified that this is now my lot in life. Mm-hmm. Paired with, I shared about the family history and I'd seen a lot of family members go down this route where they had some sleep issues and now they're on different and
medications.
Cocktail of medication. So, and that was always a fear for me that was going to happen to me at some point. And so in that moment, I was like, is this the moment? So what ends up happening is fire is lit under me to figure this out because I'm very scared. Yeah. And I start testing a lot of trial and error. I spend a ton of time, energy, effort, money. And naturally, it's actually almost like a joke on my website. If you go to the about page, it's this absurd list of laundry list of things that I tried and many failed and certain things worked, certain things didn't, but eventually was able to restore my sleep. And that was in the process of actually having to travel back to America, kind of tail between our legs, and really having the sense at that moment that maybe, you know, that life that I wanted to create for myself isn't possible because I'm going to have such a small kind of existence where I have a whole set of requirements that I now need to even get sleep.
Right.
And that was fearful for me as well because it just felt like such a failure. So eventually what ended up happening as I started going down this path was not only restoring my sleep because I shared it wasn't even that great before, clearly, but actually getting to experience optimal sleep, which I didn't think was even possible for me. And when I say optimal, I mean both from a subjective and objective experience because I started bringing in different types of tracking and ways to measure this. And that has now become a component of our business. But at the time, this became a whole new world because I used to have it that you woke up feeling exhausted, headachy, just absolutely a lack
drag
of rejuvenation.
Drag yourself.
I thought that was life. Yeah. You know, it's like the goldfish analogy. They don't know that they're in the water. That's just how life is. I thought that's how life was.
Yeah.
And so when I actually got to experience that, wait, I can feel good on a routine basis. This was life-changing to me. So What ended up happening was finally, once I discovered particularly this world of chronobiology, the science of time and how time affects our biology, circadian rhythm, which really provided a blueprint for me of how to live my life that turned upside down everything I was doing before and now gave me this kind of roadmap, it landed for me of like, how are we not all talking about this?
Yeah.
It is so life-changing.
Yes, which is why we both seem like zealot crazy people, but it's because once you know the information, you're like, why is everybody like, for me, I'm like, why would everybody not get tested for sleep apnea if they have these symptoms?
Totally. 100%. And I mean, just real quick, a quick tangent for that on that topic. I would love to see a future, and I'd imagine you are there with me, where everyone gets tested for sleep apnea multiple times throughout their life, the same way we just get tested for our blood pressure. And it's this dynamic piece. And so many people don't even know that factor that, oh, I was tested years ago. That's not a topic. It could be a topic. Right. So anyway, yes, the zealotness is clear. And I see that a lot in the health and wellness community. Often when you are passionate about something, it's because you really stunk at it beforehand and you really needed that help. So all that to say, flash forward, what I started was more organically. I just started working with people because I was on a million forums and boards. And so once things started working a bit more for me, I started sharing this information because I was so empathetic for people that were struggling because I knew what that was like and so scary it's for some people. And if you're listening, you're like, well, it's not scary for me. I just would rather sleep better. That's fine. I mean, wherever you might be at on the spectrum, there are things that we can do to up level. So sleep as a skill gets created. And now flash forward, what we have put in place is this whole world is my intention anyway, is this world for people to go to where they can get one, a lot of free information to really get into this conversation, hopefully bring about curiosity, fascination on this thing that we do a third of our lives on average 26 years spent asleep. And yet so often we don't think too much about it. So having that place, I know you and I have talked about our concerns from the systemic perspective that the average doctor right now is only has about 2 hours of training, even out of Harvard Med, in sleep. And this thing that we do so often. So, you know, there's a missing of opportunities for people to go to hear more about this and to hopefully, you know, raise those red flags and what have you. So on the other side of all this, the aftermath for me is getting to experience life with great sleep, getting to share of this information for others that are struggling. And since then, we have built a very large database of Oura Ring users in particular in a place that we're able to look at sleep optimization, which is a rare, so outside of the realm of research, we're able to get more granular on what are some of those things that actually can move the needle for people
and optimize their sleep. And help people with their mindset and what they need to do better with their sleep. Right.
Exactly. Because what we're seeing too is
I think sometimes there's the tracking part, but people are missing the actual positive change part, which it seems like that's what you're really working on with them.
Absolutely. And we have so many people that they started tracking along the way. So I'm incredibly grateful for technology. It's getting more and more people into this conversation of sleep optimization. But to your point, so many people also start and stop or start and get disempowered and get that nocebo effect where they're waking up and they've got those really crappy scores. And then it's kind of setting the scene. And we see that in certain studies where we tell someone, oh, you slept really bad last night, even if they slept fine. And then they almost like lower the bar. On what's possible for them in the subsequent day. So obviously we don't want to set people up in that way. So we want to help educate and come from this perspective that sleep is a skill set in our modern society because we have gotten so divorced from some of the ways that will naturally support improved sleep results.
Okay, so that segued beautifully into
perfect.
What I next wanted to ask you about. So a lot of the people, so obviously a lot of the people listening have sleep apnea. And I think so many of us, you know, however long it's taken us to get a diagnosis, we've struggled with our sleep for a long time. We finally get this diagnosis of sleep apnea. And the doctor says, you know, like gives us a treatment or we go to a dentist or whatever the treatment might be. And we kind of think to ourselves, well, we're all done here. Like whatever treatment option we have, that's going to take care of my sleep. There we go. But the problem is often with people that anyone with sleep apnea can have any of the same challenges that the general population have. in terms of like sleep hygiene and all these kind of things. So I totally know what you're going to say, but what is the one thing you think people should start with if they're new to this conversation of trying to improve the quality of their sleep and optimize everything? If they were going to start with one thing, what would it be?
Oh, you know, she knows the answer. Okay. So naturally, the place that I begin with people is around circadian rhythm entrainment. I alluded to that. What the heck does that mean? That's simply how can we begin to align our circadian rhythms, our trillions of clocks in every cell and organ in our body, of how to kind of stay on time of this 24-hour rhythm. And the reason that we do that, and granted, it's not to step over CBTI, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, yes, can be fantastic, and that can work in tandem with the things that I'm discussing. And often we see that. We see people come in and they've maybe worked with CBTI and they want to have some additional resources. So there's a lot there. But from this circadian rhythm entrainment piece, this can be groundbreaking because this can actually help support a lot of the foundational components of why people are struggling so much for their sleep. Why do we have to do so much work to influence our thought patterns at certain times in the evening? Why do we have to have 9 million apps to meditate ourselves to sleep and calm our stinking nerves?
Yeah.
Why do we need all of this? Now, part of what I point to, and I'm sorry that this is such a long answer,
but I'll
bring it together. One of the places that I begin is like, why is this a problem? And my most referenced study that I often point to is out of 2001, where the EPA found that the average person was spending about 93% of their time indoors, and that broke down to indoor environments and automobiles. And both structures are actually changing the environment that you're in, by which it affects some of the cues of our biology of what time it is and what to be doing when. Because it turns out that the body is constantly sampling its environment to get a sense of what should it be doing from a hormonal perspective, from some of the preparatory components. Say if it knows that we always eat at 7 a.m., it will prepare for that in advance, and it likes to have that heads up. Now, when you're in these indoor environments, it's closing us off from some of the rhythms of nature that our ancestors, when you know we were hunter-gatherers, if you will, living outdoors, we would have been cued into all of these signals so clearly.
Without even trying. They're just going about their business being outdoors all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. So a lot of this would get handled if we were to kind of return and move out to nature. Now, I know we're not going to necessarily do that. If you want to do that, great. But what it points to, or what are some of those key time givers that tell the body what time it is and what to be doing when? If you want to get fancy, they're called Zeitgebers. And these Zeitgebers are incredibly important. What is the most important one to your question? Light-dark signaling. That is number one. And there are more, but that is the number one place to begin. And one of the reasons that that's so crucial is that we're finding that the average person is in an environment by day that is around 100 times too dim as compared to the outdoor environment. And that includes if you're around windows, which are still beneficial. It's still better. We see studies with, you know, patients in hospitals that are able to have a faster release time if they're in spots that have connection to outdoor rhythms and lighting, but it's still insufficient to really bring about this optimal result. And in the evening, the average person is in an environment that is about 100 times too bright as compared to the brightest moonlit evenings. But all this means that the average person is sitting there listening to this in a circadian disrupted state. Point blank, period. That's what's going on, because the average person is inside, kind of like these modern zoo animals that we've become, and under these electric lights. Now, if you're listening and you're in some sort of amazing cabin outdoor situation, yay you. But the average person is not doing that. So we got a big problem. So that's where we want to begin. So one of the anchor components that I speak about, if you get nothing out of what I'm talking about, I hope that you get this, is that there are a couple anchor behaviors that you could bring in. So the first one is that you're getting up at about the same time, 7 days a week, and there's a little bit of fluctuation and what have you with that, but that we're aiming to have that consistency. And if you were really circadian aligned, that might be within alignment with the seasons and mm-hmm. all of that, which would be fantastic. I understand not everyone's going to do that. So at least just beginning with that 7 days a week. Now, pairing that anchor part of your day with bright light exposure. So physically getting up and out and outside, not from behind windows. I'm in front of these windows if you're seeing this video. And if I was to rest on my laurels and only get the bright light exposure from behind these windows, we find that in certain studies, it could take anywhere from 50 to 100 times longer to reset that master clock from behind. Outside. So get outside and without sunglasses, without hats, all of these things, because I mentioned all those trillions of clocks. Well, those are peripheral clocks that are really governed by this master clock, this suprachiasmatic nucleus that is directly connected to our eyes, which is why we find that this light-dark signaling is so crucial. So you want to make sure that those eyes especially are exposed to that bright light, obviously with safety in mind. You're not staring like a crazy person at the sun, but and in that general
and
direction.
That works even if like it's overcast or it's ideal. It's like sunlight, but like even if it's overcast, people should still just get outside.
Even if it's overcast. So the people in my programs become quite attuned to this kind of physics of light, not just for fun, but because it's so crucial to understand. So, because it's a fantastic question. That's one of the first things we always hear is, well, you don't understand. I'm in Seattle or whatever, and it's
or
so
Scotland.
Cloudy. Or Scotland, exactly, totally. I grew up in Maine, around the border of Canada, you know, all these different places. And so many people say, why bother? It is dreary out. I'm not even going to. So it's instead of the why bother, the kind of bad news insight is that actually when it is overcast, when it is cloudy, what it would be kind of behoove us to stay outside longer, just a little bit longer because of the fact that it is a little bit impacted, but it's still going to be measurably much most often, unless it's some sort of like end of days moment, but most of the times when you go outside, it's going to be much brighter than your indoor environment. If you want to take this to the next level, which often I find for people, they need some kind of buy-in to understand why this is so important. So you can, for like a buck or so, download either a light meter app, Lux. There's different apps that what you'll do is you'll take your smartphone and you'll start to just kind of sample different environments. You can go into the Starbucks that maybe you're working at or whatever the heck you're doing, your indoor work environment, your where you spend a lot of your time by day, and then go outside. And what you'll often see is a massive shift. So the average indoor environment is most often very clearly sub 1,000 Lux, if not much lower on that kind of scale. You go outside, it can get to 100,000 lux on a bright summer day near the equator. But certainly even we're talking 5,000, 10,000, 20,000, much more. And this, you know, you could be like, oh, this is just neurotic. What's the big deal? No, it is a huge deal. So it's a part of the process of actually being able to create sufficient melatonin in the evening, which can be confusing. Why would light affect that? Because I thought it was a hormone of darkness. And yes, that's true. You need darkness present to support the production of melatonin. But there's a whole world of the conversation of the connection between your bright light exposure by day. And so if you're in these dim environments, which most of us are, you know, I can measure some of my indoor environments and it might be like, we're talking 100 lux. If I just sit in that all day, that can be a big, huge problem for how much sleep pressure I'm going to have by the end of the night. But even beyond that, hormonal production, cognition, because you're going to get a bit of an excitatory effect when you're in that bright light. I want you to think about light dark as a real drug-like effect. And how do we say that? Any drug is kind of produces a measurable effect enough to, you know, create a study around it. And that's what this is, phototherapy. So getting outside will have that excitatory effect. It will cut off any lingering melatonin production that might be present if you've got really crazy schedules. So this is going to really serve you. Flip side, in the evenings, you want to have that experience
before
of darkness,
we go on to
bathing
the evening,
in that.
Really quick.
Yes.
So for
please.
People that are listening or watching who work in your standard office, how much time would they optimally spend outside, maybe first thing in the morning? Or do they need to like find time during the day that they can get outside as well? Or what kind of time periods?
Great questions. Okay. So one, I'm going to give you a couple of resources that can help guide you, because depending on where you are on the globe, this does kind of shift a bit, what the season is, a number of things. So one, the Circadian app is super helpful for this. Circadian Life, if you need to find it on Google or what have you. So the Circadian Life app is going to actually geotag you where you are and understand what time sun rises in your location, sunset, and then what would make sense based on the different changes, because sun is dynamic. It's not just the same type of sun. You're getting very different sun in the morning, which is infrared rich. There's a whole different change that happens with the stretching of the sun across the horizon. So when you go outside in that morning, it tells the body something about what time it is and what to be doing when. We want to have this beautiful high cortisol pulse, not too high, but not too low, cortisol pulse in the morning. And when you start moving that out, so if you get delayed bright light exposure or not sufficient bright light exposure, then that can kind of have a delayed cortisol pulse, which is a signature of some of our sleep troubles for a lot of people. I certainly had that. I was like getting stressed going into sleep, which is the opposite of what we want to do.
Right.
So instead, how do you know how long to stay out? There's a lot of differences that might be present depending on where you are in the globe, but bare minimum, what I would say is from a behavioral change perspective, having that small habit of even just beginning with a few minutes would be a huge win for the average person. And then if you can work yourself up to around 10 to 20 minutes, that can often really serve as
so doable. It's
totally doable. So that's the morning.
Are you a new or struggling CPAP user? Are you waking up and flinging your CPAP mask across the room in frustration? Maybe you have mask leaks, skin irritation, or wake up with a dry mouth. You might be dealing with uncomfortable trapped gas from swallowing air or hair breakage from your headgear. If any of this sounds familiar, you're not alone, and I wrote a workbook just for you. The 6-week CPAP Solutions Workbook is out now and has been designed to give you solutions to all the most common CPAP problems. Visit sleepapneastories.com to order now. That's sleepapneastories.com. Let's get into nighttime so that I can just sympathize with your husband with all of the red fridge, the red Christmas tree, all of the stuff.
So you mean my Darth Vader that he calls me?
We might have to do an intervention, but let's just get into nighttime and what you recommend around life.
Totally, 100%. My poor husband, Blake, he literally got me a Darth Vader costume, so you might be seeing some funny Darth Vader content coming. Yes, our place is very red. And just to complete too with the bright light, the only other thing I'd call out is ideally don't just make it the morning, that's the beginning, but do make sure the same way smokers used to take their smoke breaks outside and they would just always make that happen.
Yeah.
We want to always make that happen, just quick sun breaks throughout the course of the day, just little amounts. Yeah. And even just a few photons of light can tell the body something about the time. Okay, so now you're in the nighttime, the sun has set. What do? Now, ideally, there of course is a spectrum here, and I understand that not everyone is going to move into the Darth Vader side of things, the dark side. But so if you don't want to do that, totally get it. But we're trying to simply mimic the rhythms of nature. If we think we're dealing with a recency fallacy, a recency effect right now, because we all think that this is normal. You just flip on the lights and what's the big deal? 145 years ago now, Edison created the light bulb. Before that, we were still so tethered to these rhythms. Yes. So it's, even though this can seem so weird or what have you, it's really much more in alignment with the thousands of years of how we evolved. And our biology is still acting in accordance with all of those years, not this new odd behavior that we're all doing now. So think about that. But what you can do is simply almost hopefully make this a fun thing, dare I say, where you're bringing in these warm lighting tones. So you're bringing in orange and reds, candles, Himalayan salt lamps. If you want to get really fancy, the angle of the light can also be important too. So, you know, you almost mimic kind of fire. That was what we evolved around first, kind of real biohack was fire.
I feel like back in the day, you recommended a light bulb to me that is kind of like just a warm white, but it has less of, it has more of the red and less of the blue or something?
There are different light bulbs on the market that they are specifically devoid of the blues, and some have pulled out some of the green lights, which also has some question of could that somewhat impact melatonin. That's still questionable, but certainly the blue light, pulling that and extracting that out. Now that can make a big difference. Often you can search for those as like sleep friendly light bulbs, that sort of thing. And this is such a big deal that just last year, nearly 250 circadian scientists referencing almost 2,700 peer-reviewed publications are now calling for these warning labels on light bulbs at night, just not just because of sleep-wake, but also because of all these other health factors, including obesity, reproductive disorders, psychiatric disorders, or mental health being impacted by this. Yeah. Like, why do we need all this CBTI to be able to fall asleep? Not to discount CBTI, but it's, do understand that our thoughts are conducting themselves on a diurnal rhythm. So there is a real shift of having the quality of the types of our thoughts. We have certainly studies to back this up. There's one called The Mind After Midnight, where we find suicidality rates go up in the wee hours of the morning, depressive, anxious.
Yeah, I had Dr. Michael Granier on, and he was talking about suicide.
His lab was the one that had The Mind After Midnight. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, we're still gathering this information, but we're of the thinking that there's real change that happens as diurnal creatures. We're meant to be active by day and at rest at night. And when we start deviating from that, we know unequivocally, particularly out of shift workers and some of the research there, of some of the deleterious effects for health. So we want to try to align with these rhythms to some degree. And there will be, of course, be fluctuations in what people are able to commit to and responsibilities and all that. But what would be ideal? If when the sun is setting, how can we just bring about more of those warm hues in the evening? And then what that's doing is helping to support that we're not depleting some of those melatonin reserves and having to then supplement with melatonin, which, by the way, in certain countries, you have to get prescriptions to get melatonin. Exactly, right? It's a hormone, you know, just, and so there's lots of thoughts about melatonin. I'm not, you know, meaning to discount that, but it's, there's certainly the ability to produce more on our own. And part of it has to do with the darkness.
So in your house, let's paint a picture. So are you using screens after like night?
Totally. I love my technology, so I don't want
100%. Are you using glasses that filter? What are you doing, Molly?
What's happening? Tell us. A little expose on this weird behavior. Okay, so what this can look like, and all my clients, when we go through our cohort programs and one-on-ones and all the things, some of the things that I really require for them, if you're watching this video, that one, I want for the little screens, so, you know, for your phone to look like this after night. Oh. So this, so if you're watching the video, it's a very red color.
If you're listening to the audio, it just went red.
Yes, exactly. It just went red. How do you do that? You can easily do that on iPhone. There's a hidden setting. You can literally just Google this or go to our site. But if you Google sleep iPhone color filter setting, and then it will show you how to set this up. It takes like 2 minutes maybe, but then you have it for life. And then if you have an Android, you can get the Twilight app, and then this will turn all red. So that's the little screens. For the big screens, like, you know, on your laptop, I use Iris Tech. Iris Tech is really helpful because it allows for the sleep setting, and it also cuts out flicker rate, which is a longer conversation. The physics of light is the whole thing, but there can be a lot of things that can be stressful to the body, even though we might not realize it. So Iris Tech takes care of that for us, so then we don't have to worry about that, and it turns your screen that same bright red that's on, not quite bright, we don't want it too bright, because all light, by the way, of any spectrum can be more excitatory. So don't just think that, well, just douse myself in floodlights of red, that can be problematic too. You want low intensity as well.
So are you watching TV with a red?
So yes. So what I do with the TV piece now, you might have seen, I just did a podcast with a gentleman who has a company that makes custom red filters that go over your TV. I have not quite gone there. Blake is really against that one.
My husband would be not on team Let's Make the TV Red.
Totally. I know. Blake is not there for me at all. He loves his blue light. So this has been like an ongoing thing to get him to like get off the blue drug.
Yeah.
Anyway, but so the blue light is still present in our TV. And so what I will do when we're watching TV, I do try to have us kind of have that a little bit on the earlier side, but we love to watch, you know, there can be a really calming practice. We watch The Office or Funny Things or Light Things, where possible. Blue blockers can be, that's kind of my go-to. Now, I would suggest
that's
for people
glasses that have blue light.
Exactly.
Blocking.
Okay. Exactly. Now, orange and red are the two suggestions that I would have for that in the evening. Why? Because a lot of people have been marketed to over the years of clear blue light blocking glasses. Unfortunately, those are not going to do the trick for what we want to do for the evening. So they need to be at least orange. And that's what most people, I find the orange to be the most user-friendly for the average person. And how do you check and make sure that it's actually blocking light? You simply stand in front of something that has blue light very clearly. I actually had this silly moment where I had this tea kettle that had had this glowing blue light, and I had the blue blockers on, and I had just this like stupid moment where I said, and I started banging at the thing, and I said, why is this thing not on? This is so stupid. And because I had the blue blockers on, that cut all the blue. So that's how you check is just look at blue. And if it's blocking it, it's working. If it's not, then it's not working.
Got it.
So, and they don't have to be wildly expensive. You can go on Amazon. There's lots of different, my first
And you
pair
have on your website, you have links to things, don't you?
Totally. We got links to things. If you want them to be fancy, I've got some like cooler ones now so I can feel like not as crazy when I go out and wear them. But you can also get them for 10. My first pair was in 2016. There were UVEX, the construction worker glasses. Consumer Reports gave the check off and they were like under 10 bucks. So, you know, whatever you want to get, you can get. So wearing those when you are exposed to blue light sources. But my aim is to just kind of eliminate most blue light sources so I don't have to wear them too often because I kind of don't love wearing them, honestly.
Right.
So when I don't have to, I don't want to.
So you have red film that you have put into your refrigerator. And I'm like suppressing my judgment right now. And it's like film that you just put over the so that you don't get exposed to any blue light at all. And so,
totally.
So yeah, I'm not sure I'm doing that, Molly, but like
I understand. There is a spectrum here. There's a spectrum here. Now, I think what happens, and this is what I've seen for people, in the beginning, all of this lands as so bizarro because we've been so used to that you go to, I don't know, your grandmother's and there's light all over the place and it's, you know, 8 p.m. and you're just how life has been.
Yeah.
And that's the normalcy. And it's actually quite comforting for a lot of us. You know, a lot of people maybe listening might be familiar with Dr. Matthew Walker, who wrote Why We Sleep. And one of the things that he coined it is being called a dark, deprived society that we're all living in at this current point in time. Now, as a result, one of the things, is, and I've referenced this for years in my talks, but just recently they kind of quantified that last year, 2023, had record-breaking searches for sleep on Google Trends. And, you know, we've been seeing this. If you look back, there's like this Mount Everest rise. Why are so many people struggling? Well, one of the components is that in around the 80s, moving into the 90s, a big surge and push for LED light sources became really important and prevalent from an energy savings perspective, which is true. It saves a lot of energy. But from a biology perspective, what is this doing to us? We're only just understanding this now. So once you start bringing some of this in, then you start to be attuned to more of that light source in your environment. Because also what you want to understand is that your light and your eye sensitivity is dynamic and shifts throughout the course of the day. It has its own circadian rhythm. So just by simply existing by day, if you have that same light source in the morning and then you have that same light source in the evening, you're more sensitive in the evening than you are at different times. Also, importantly, some people are more sensitive to these changes than others. We are very clear that people like that are dealing with bipolar are very sensitive to some of these changes in light source. So I am of the estimation that one of the things we're finding is that some of us might be dealing with more sensitivity than others. The best way to illustrate this is those beautiful studies out of the University of Colorado, Kenneth Wright's group, where he took people that have all, you know, different bedtimes and actually many that kind of identified as night owls, if you will, and took them camping and Both times he took them for one long week and the second time for kind of a long weekend. In both cases, in measuring their melatonin productions and seeing the results of when they fell asleep, simply the presence of being in bright days, dark nights, markedly dark nights, no electric light anywhere, they started to move back their sleep onset time. So this is a big deal. So people will say to me all the time, I can't turn off my brain. I can't fall asleep. I can't stay asleep. This is part of it.
Right.
So you want to get aware of the fact that some of these things are stealing your ability to have that peace in your day. If it's going to take a $10, you know, film of red, whatever, I'm there for it.
Right. It's so fascinating. I love it. So here's one thing I really wanted to ask you about. So you have cohorts of people in your group coaching wearing their Oura rings, and you're encouraging them to kind of like have better sleep hygiene and do all the right things for their sleep, right? And I'm interested in, I know that you've had people with sleep apnea in that, right?
Sure.
So yeah. I'm really interested in what you've found to be really helpful for those people.
Oh, absolutely. So a couple things. Our first onboarding week is really more laborious, where they are taking, they're going through our modules. So each week they have these different modules, but in the onboarding week, they go through these particular modules and then they go through a number of assessments. And within those sleep assessments, we're also flagging for possible sleep disorders from more of an inventory perspective. Mm-hmm. Now, naturally, this is not diagnostic. This is right. Just can raise some red flags, and we can then help escort them into the direction of working with one, getting tested, whether in lab or at home,
yep.
And starting to get the ball rolling on getting more information if it appears that that would might make sense. I personally, because I am so biased, I do really recommend for a lot of people, if available to them, that we can go through a sleep study just to ensure that we're not missing anything. Yeah. I would like to see a future where we're all testing for this.
Yeah.
I often use Blake, my husband, as an example, because he was a great example that, and he's given me permission to share about this so I can. He had none of the symptoms that you might think about. He was not a snorer, not, you know, overweight, yep. Not all those things. And you know this yep. more than anyone, of all those kind of surprising things that can come out once we get tested. Now, he ended up getting tested only because I have like 9 million things coming my way of different. So I make him my guinea pig for everything. And so what comes back is that he has more of this REM dependent sleep apnea.
Yes.
And so what he's seeing is these particular results of this kind of mild sleep apnea, but so disruptive and yes. like so problematic. So with that, for him, I use him as an example, because then he's done some more out of the box things with, he's actually worked with Sleep Better Austin mm-hmm. over here, which we know the people over there. And so he has used the Excite OSA and oral appliances.
When is he coming? That. Blake needs to come on my podcast. Oh my word.
I think we might have to have that happen.
And he's
right?
getting better though since he got some treatment.
Oh, it's been life-changing for him. He's awesome. He always shares his, because he's in a lot of different groups where he'll wear like the Whoop band and the, you know, different things. And he's always like Mr. Number One in all these groups because he's so, you know, the intensity of the sleep stuff over here. But all that to say, to answer your original question, what we aim to do is very quickly get people tested up front and then beginning to make sure that we're treating that in a particular way and that they're aware of all, you know, as many different kind of out of the box ways that they might be able to treat as well. Because we also have a number of people that come through and they say, oh, CPAP wasn't for me.
Right.
Exactly. And so, and I use you as a reference. I share about your book. Yeah. So anyway, so we'll make sure that we have some accountability, because now they're coming on. We have two calls a week. Everyone gets is guaranteed individualized coaching on each, every single week at least. So one time a week that we're talking just with them to find out where are they at. And then we can share screen, look at their Oura Ring stats, and we can understand what's working, what's not working, and make sure they're perpetually in action and supported along that journey.
Mm-hmm. And so are you finding, I feel like one time you mentioned to me that you'd seen a big difference with movement and like doing the 10,000 steps and that kind of thing. Like,
oh my goodness. Oh, so this is going in, of course, you know, to clarify an asterisk, you know, there's no stepping over the need to make sure we have those very clear protocols in place, whether it's CPAP or appliances, yep. you know, whatever we might be using to approach that, to approach sleep apnea. So of course we're doing that. But what can we do from a behavioral change perspective in alignment? So certainly there are a number of things that we might bring in. The thing that you were pointing to, which I just continually find fascinating, is the power of plain old stinking walking. Yeah. And if you look at kind of hunter-gatherer, the closest estimation of how we used to live are certain remaining groups like the Hadza tribe in Africa, who have actually been outfitted with aura rings, by the way. We had one of the sleep anthropologists from out of Canada that had been there and did some work with the Hadza tribe, outfitted with aura rings. And we, one, find that they walk far more than the average person does here. So we understand that that was likely a big part of our kind of movement, what brought up sleep pressure and all those things in the past. And we've kind of gotten away from that in our sedentary lifestyles. Yep. But nature has, so in nature is a more robust study that looks at a number of markers of health that are improved just by plain old step count. And what they found was sleep apnea being involved in some of those results in that particular study. So in that one, what they found was 8,000 and steps being a bit of the bare minimum. However, then they did find improvements, kind of like this nice, you know, hill or climb mountain that would go up in accordance with the amount of steps you might add in. So another 10,000, 12,000, and it seems to help minimize some of the results with what we're looking to achieve with sleep apnea.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's just one thing. Now, because certainly we know that different things that can bring about a cascading effect for weight loss can be helpful for sleep apnea, of course. We know that some of those studies of or the reports that a 10% weight increase in overall body weight can bring about a sixfold increase in your likelihood for sleep apnea. So what would happen on the reverse? Now, one of the unexpected things that we found for a number of people that participate in our programs is that they end up losing quite a bit of weight because, one, we're doing things like circadian rhythm, intermittent fasting. We know the timing of food can absolutely flare up more of the chances that we'll be dealing with apneas throughout the course
super
of the night.
Interesting. And that ties in so nicely with, I just interviewed Dr. Stephen Park recently, and he was talking about just having people not eat close to bedtime makes a huge difference. There's so many people with sleep apnea who also are dealing with reflux or any of these kind of issues. And he was saying just finishing eating 3 or 4 hours before bedtime can make a huge difference for a lot of people.
Totally. And I was so grateful to have the opportunity to connect with Kristen Holmes. She's the vice president of performance sciences at Whoop. And she was sharing that they're in the process of what appears to be favorable results in a study that they're looking at with all their Whoop participants of 4 hours before bed, having your last bite of food versus 2 hours before bed.
Interesting.
Now, the bare minimum and the one that has the most robust studies are with Dr. Sachin Panda, decades of, you know, information and research on circadian meal timing. He's got an app called the On Time app. We did a podcast with him and it's one of our more popular for last year. And his research points to bare minimum about 3 to 2 hours before bed having your last bite of food. Now, that is really established from a circadian perspective. So if you were to do even just that, that could be really beneficial. Now, I will say anecdotally and some small studies showing certain benefits from moving it even further than that. Mm-hmm. So we find things like 4-5 hours or more before bed, having your last bite of food. And this would be more in alignment with circadian rhythm, intermittent fasting, where you're eating largely when the sun is out, you're largely giving a digestive break when the sun has set. So even if you do that one, if you test that one approach, that can be really life-changing. Now, do know our metabolic timing is a circadian component. So it might take some time, just like jet lag, where you feel a little off and you're, so in the case of hunger, you might have trained yourself to eat later. Mm-hmm. I used to do that. I used to be very proud of the fact that I'd say, oh, I don't eat breakfast and I, you know, don't eat until 12, 1, whatever. But it turned out that I trained myself to do that. And you can just as easily entrain yourself earlier to front load your calories. But just know that it might take some time and you might still have a little bumps until you train that properly.
So clearly I could talk to you all day, Molly. Tell everybody how they can work with you, where they can find you, where they should be following you, all of your things.
All the things. Oh, yes. Well, one, thank you so much for having me on and taking the time. I love your work. It's just so life-changing. So having said that, if people are listening and they want to get more into this wacky Darth Vader world of sleep optimizing, at sleepisaskill.com, it aims to serve as kind of a bucket for a number of things. One, you can take a sleep assessment and get auto-triggered some resources right away based around what you're dealing with. So that can be step number one. You can sign up for our weekly newsletter that comes out every every Monday. We've been doing that for over 5 years. So that's been a really cool way. We respond to every single email. So it really plays as a way to keep that conversation alive and all free information. We have our weekly sleep podcast. And so where you get different sleep experts from different areas and people that might have some of this information around the circadian approach as well. So bringing that out. Then if you're really struggling and you want some further support, then we have those online courses. We have one-on-ones. We also have something we've been doing since the last year and change called sleep wearable audits. And those have been really a cool opportunity. So you can come in. So if you're tracking, you just kind of want to get a little bit of another set of eyes on your numbers, then we particularly do that right now with Aura and Whoop. Now that might be shifting, but as of right now, we can do that. So it gives you an opportunity to kind of get an audit of how you're performing and some certain things you might be able to bring in. Good.
Well, listen, great. Molly, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you. I so appreciate it. And more to come, my friend.
Yeah. Thanks so much for listening. I love hearing from you. If you'd like to be featured in an upcoming episode of the podcast, please email me at sleepapneastories@gmail.com. That's also the place to get in touch if you just want to say hi or ask a question. Alternatively, I'm over on Instagram. My handle there is sleepapneastories. If you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe or follow, rate and review wherever you listen. This really helps a wider audience find the episodes, and I really appreciate it.